when I sold everything, I go on the road, I promised myself, I say, I have enough money for 10 years. After 10 years, I have nothing left.
Hey folks, welcome to today's show. Sorry for getting the episode up just a little bit late. If you're, you know, if you missed it on your morning commute, I'm very sorry. And by the way, my name's Mason. I'm usually the host here, but today we're actually doing a special throwback episode because today marks the 4-year anniversary that one of our alumni here on Adventure Sports Podcast passed away. Hubert Kriegel died of aortic dissection in 2018 on this day, and he was famous for selling everything he had in 2005 to go travel around the world with his Ural motorcycle that had a sidecar. And we're going to hear stories about that today, but I wanted to read a quote that he said about this trip. He said, "Selling everything I had in 2005 to go travel around the world on my sidecar was the best decision I ever made in my life. Don't forget to take a risk today." So in honor of Hubert, in honor of that spirit of adventure, in honor of what he did, I wanted to talk to him again. So this episode's from a few years ago. Travis is hosting the show. So my apologies for getting it up a little bit late. But hey, sometimes adventure makes us a little late. So let's go ahead and jump in.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Adventure Sports Podcast. This is Travis. I've got a good show for you guys today. I caught up with Hubert Kriegel on the western shore of India, about 300 miles south of Mumbai. Hubert has been visiting various parts of the world since 1970, but in 2005, he decided to sell it all and travel permanently for 10 years on a Ural motorcycle and sidecar. Now it's 11 years later, and you've probably already guessed it, but Hubert is still on the road and apparently with no plans to stop anytime soon. Hubert, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know, I came across your story, and I was just completely smitten by your ability to toss everything aside and head out on this Ural sidecar and start traveling the world. Let's jump right into it. What kicked this whole thing off? You had basically an epiphany, a certain moment that just made you realize that this is what you wanted to do with your life at this point.
Look, it's one of the things that happens during one dinner in my life. So we are in November 2004. I was living in New York. I've been living in America for the last 25 years on that time. I'm French. And during that dinner, I'm with a very good friend of mine. He's French also. And this guy is a noise, you know, he's a perfume designer. And he's telling me as we start the dinner, he said, you know, no matter how much we make, when we live in a big city like New York, it's a lifestyle. And December 31st, you look in your pocket, it's empty. It's all gone. So, which is true. So just so you know, I was never rich in my life. I had a good life. But I was always always in the red all my life. And so that was the beginning of our conversation. And then he said, look, your daughter, I have three daughters. My third daughter was in Madison, Wisconsin College. It was the last year of her college. So he said, so now you're going to be released of not to have to pay college and things like that. What are you going to do? So I felt quite stupid. I never thought about it. I said, well, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I keep working and, you know, and that's it. And then the conversation started during the same dinner. And they say, you know, Jean-Louis, my French friend in New York, is passionate about motorcycle like me. We have always been driving motorcycles since we are a teenager. And he's also a traveler, a true traveler, like I have been. I've been traveling all my life, also on my own way. And then Jean-Louis asked me, he said, you know, it would be interesting to see how much does it cost to travel on motorcycle all year long. That's all you do. You know, how much we need to do that. So just to remind you, we're in 2004. We all have internet on our desk in the morning when I was coming to work. The first thing I was doing, it was looking at a couple of bikers I knew. I had their blog, you know, traveling around the world, and I was dreaming about it. You know, I was looking at that. It was like a dream come true, you know. So we start to scoop some number, and we broke it down on the tablecloth, and we come to what was coherent and just common sense. And then Jean-Louis tell me, he say, but, you know, you, if you sell everything you have, how much do you have? I say, I have no clue. You know, I mean, at the bank, I'm always in the red, but, you know, like anybody else, I had a good life, and I was living in a very nice apartment, and I was a real estate broker at that time, so I had to look good, and I was looking good. So, like anybody else, I had stuff, but no money. So we did the number. Again, we scooped the number, you know, whatever was making sense about. And at the end, it appeared that if I was selling everything, I had enough money to travel for 10 years on my motorcycle, because traveling on a motorcycle is very cheap if that's all you do. Of course, you have to travel smart, you know. I don't go in a 5-star hotel. So when I look at that, we were to desert, and I say, you know, are you sure we don't forget anything? And so then it was clear to me that I had two choices in life. The first one was I keep working 10 years and then I will be poor. And the second one, I sell everything I have, I go travel for 10 years on my motorcycle, and then I will be poor.
Either way, it's the same result.
Yeah, I mean, that was, wow, you know, it was a wake-up call. I mean, I had no idea before that dinner. Drinking the coffee, I look at Jean-Louis, I say, Jean-Louis, I'm selling everything, I go on the road. I took my decision, it was just simple. So we are November 2004, 3 months later, February 16, at 6:04 a.m., I was leaving Manhattan, and I was going on the road for 10 years. Everything was gone, everything was sold, everything was closed, I had nothing left in New York. And I've been on the road since. You know, it was absolutely fantastic. I owe a lot to my good friend Jean-Louis. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think you do.
That's how it happened. Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's still a very close friend. We talk a lot together. He came to join me a couple of times. One time 6 months in South America on his motorcycle, and then we drove 1 year together in Africa. But you know, that's it. That's the story.
Oh, that's fun. Well, I've always been, you know, proud of myself for deciding, you know, to move out to Colorado from Connecticut and doing it within a month's time. 4 weeks later, we packed up and moved out. And I was always pretty proud of that until I heard your story where you decided to sell everything and go on the road for 10 years on a motorcycle and did it within 3 months. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, okay, it happens like that. I mean, obviously, I was, you know, it wasn't the first time I moved. I was living in France, and I met my wife, and we had a baby. She was 3 months old, and we decided to move to America. So, again, we sold, packed everything, and came here with four suitcases, and, you know, nobody was waiting for us. We had to redo our life, which we did, you know, so. Somehow it was not the first time, but still it was a very good move, you know.
Yeah, you were used to making big changes quickly. So speaking of your wife, now we need to point out that you're married. You've been on the road for 11 years now, but there's still a wife back in New York. How does that work out? How does she feel about it?
All right. So I can see right away you want to put me in trouble. My wife is next to me, so let me tell you. Yeah. So look, Lorraine, she's a dancer. She was a professional dancer all her life. And as time goes, you know, from dancing on stage, she became a choreographer. She became a professor of dance, teaching in universities in New York. writing books about dance, and that's her passion in life. She, the same way my passion was never to work, because I was never good to work, but my passion was always travel and motorcycle. So when I decided to go on the road, you know, the conversation we had, what we said was, look, you leave your passion, which is dance, and I leave my passion, which is traveling on a motorcycle. You are teaching now in a New York University. There is a lot of holiday. Every time you have time off, I will come back and we are together. And then once in a while, you can come to join me wherever. So that's what we do. Every Christmas, I was back in New York. We were together with our daughter for a month and a half, 2 months. Then a month for spring break, and then a couple of months in summer. And sometimes she come join me, in different countries. She's here in India with me right now for the last 7 weeks. She come in Panama. She come, we went travel Europe. I mean, so look, it's not the way we did it. No. It is important to see that living in 2000, in the 21st century, you have to recognize that traveling is very easy, in the sense that every country has internet. Every country has a plastic machine. You know, you put the plastic on top, you get the cash on the bottom. Every country has airplane, international airplane. For $1,000 from wherever you are in the world, you can tonight jump in a plane and wake up tomorrow morning on the other side of the world. So we are on Skype. We talk daily together, email. Of course, I'm not connected every day, but every time I can connect, we communicate together. And we always say, if you have a problem, if there's something, I jump in a plane, I come back, and some in both way, So, and it did happen that way. So I jump in the plane a couple of times. One day she lost her dad. I was next day with her, and I stayed with her the time we had to. And one day I was very sick and she came and she helped me and she bring me back home and things like that. So, it's not like I leave and I say, okay, see you in 10 years, ciao, It will not work the same way, of course.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You guys have found a way to make this a very small world and be with each other when you need each other. And you obviously have a very strong relationship to endure that. And I think I can speak on the behalf of many men around the world and say, sir, you are very lucky. And I think you know how lucky you are. And that's it's such a wonderful story to hear.
Yeah, I like to say that because we were talking about how easy it is to travel today, convenient and cheap. In 1971, I was living in Paris, and I went on a sidecar, motorcycle with a sidecar. I went around the Red Sea, so that includes leaving from France, you go to Yugoslavia, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Sudan, Egypt. And that was a four-month trip. And we left for 2 months, but we came back after 4 months. And when you leave France, you go to Italy, that's okay. From Italy, you enter Yugoslavia, you are gone. You are disconnected from the world. You don't know anything that happens in your own country with your family, your friend, or people you know. And nobody knows what's happening with you. We're in 1971. The telephone exists in every country. It is very difficult to get the telephone connection. It takes a lot of time, and it's very expensive. We did it 2 times in 4 months. So, on that time, I don't think it would have worked for us. The way we can do it today, it's a different world,
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is. It's a lot easier to do now. So let's talk about your mode of transportation. You ride a Ural, the sidecar, and can you go into a little bit about what a Ural is for those who might not know?
what is that you want to know about the Ural?
Yeah, the Ural motorcycle and why you chose that to spend this much time traveling.
Well, okay, so So look, when I left New York, I already had with me a BMW 100 GS, which was the last carbureted motorcycle from BMW, and I had on it a Ural sidecar. I mean, why do I drive a sidecar? There is no good reason. It's just because it works for me. I have been driving sidecar all my life. I mean, since 1971, and I love it. And I drive it like a toy. You know, it's a dance to me. And I'm not trying to convince anybody that should do it, but for me, it works. So I left New York in 2005 with a BMW. It had only 10,000 miles, very good shape, very well prepared. I've been preparing myself for the last 2 years, not to go on the road for 10 years, I have no clue, but I was preparing this motorcycle to have something to be able to do some kind of travel, you know, vacation travel. So I wanted this kind of motorcycle because no electronic, simplicity, any mechanic can open it. And you don't need a computer to fix it if there is a problem. And always wanted to go in a remote country, a remote part of the world. So that was my concept. And it worked very well, except that I very quickly learned in South America that when I left New York, I went first to the Arctic Circle, then south to Ushuaia. And going through all South America, In the next almost 3 years, I can tell you that over 100 times, either I was stranded or I U-turned with a shame because I could see there is no way I could get through the sand. So a sidecar with a one-wheel drive, you know, the sidecar is like a dead weight pulling you on the right side, and you will lose traction very quickly and be stranded. On my way south, I met a couple of guys in Death Valley, and we spent a week in Death Valley. These two guys were on the Ural with a two-wheel drive. So two-wheel drive, that means the sidecar wheel has a traction, and it's a death lock. So all of a sudden, all the power you have keep you with the traction on the sidecar, it keeps you straight, and you go much, much, much further. You know, me being alone, traveling alone, and I'm not athletic. You know, I'm just not athletic. So when you are standard, you're in deep shit. You know, it takes a lot of, it needs a lot of power, you know, to get you out of there. So I saw what the two-wheel drive Ural sidecar could do by compare of me with my one-wheel drive, much, much better motorcycles, BMW, and so on. And I was, by the time I came back from South America, I decided to buy a Ural sidecar to have the two-wheel drive. Now, let's be clear. The two-wheel drive Ural sidecar, you will not do the sand dunes that you see in the Paris-Dakar race.
Right.
No way. Yeah, forget about that. You still have huge limits, but it doesn't matter. It was going much, much farther than I could do with the BMW. So by the time I come back in 2008 now, I'm in New York, and from there I bought a new Ural sidecar, two-wheel drive. I bought it in France. And I flew there to prepare it with my friend in Geneva. You know, I have very, very good, close friends from the sidecar cross era when we were doing. Again, I was never good at sidecar cross because I'm not athletic, but I loved it, you know. So they were good, these people. Giorgio, he was competing on the world championship, you know, at that time. But I prepare my sidecar, and then I've been driving with that since, and I just love it. You know, the simplicity of the motor, absolutely what you need when you're traveling in a remote country.
Yeah, absolutely. So it has been reliable. I think I heard you say you've had 2 Urals now at this point. Is that right?
No. It's my first year. No, that I'm still driving today. The one I bought in 2008.
Okay.
So, you know, when you are traveling on year long, it's not the same mentality than when you go for the weekend with friends. You know, on the weekend with friends, you are pushing it. You do a little crazy thing. You know, you need to decompress from the week work.
Sure.
So you don't hesitate to be a little foolish. When you travel alone, loaded, and so on, you forget about that. You know, like the first question people always ask is about the speed. I mean, speed is totally irrelevant when you travel. And you don't want speed. You don't want to go fast. You want to have time to look. You don't want, and also for your own security. You know, like I'm in India, I can tell you the highway, the divided highway, are occupied by cows, by camels, by truck going the wrong way on the divided highway. You know, all of a sudden you have a truck coming in front of you. It's not every day. It's every hours we have that. So speed is really, really not something you need, and you are looking for. So I can tell you that when I'm on a very, very good road, driving 80 kilometers an hour, 80 kilometers is 50 miles an hour. 50 miles an hour. I feel, whoa, I'm flying. You know? Yeah.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. You know, on this show, we talk a lot about the adventure, but it's honestly the time between the adventure that is most important, being adventure ready, as we say. And the most important aspect of that is knowing your body and knowing what's going on inside your body. And the most important company that can help you do that is Inside Tracker, literally tracking what's going on inside your body. Inside Tracker analyzes your body's data and provides you with a clear picture of what exactly is going on so that you can make changes to your diet or see what's working, what isn't. And how they do it is they analyze all the data from your blood, DNA, lifestyle, and fitness trackers to help you optimize your body and know what's really going on. So if you'd like to learn more or get 25% off the entire Inside Tracker store, go to insidetracker.com/adventuresports. That is insidetracker.com/adventuresports. Inside Tracker can get you ready and keep you ready for all your favorite adventure sports. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So when you first headed out from New York in 2005, you went up to the Arctic Circle on the ice roads, and then you turned south and you went all the way down to Ushuaia. How much planning goes into your destinations and your travel, or is it more you just kind of go where the wind takes you at the moment?
Look, I go on a day-to-day. So every morning I have two choices. When I get out of wherever I slept, I go on my sidecar and I have two choices. The first one, I go left. The second one, I go right. And I will decide on that time. When I go on it, I say, okay, I agree. I still go left. So, and then I go. So I still have, when I left New York, it was February 16, 2005. I had a dream. Which was one of the reasons I prepared that motorcycle. I mean, the BMW, you know, with a sidecar. It was, I prepared it to go to the Arctic Circle, to Tuktoyaktuk on the ice road in winter. So you go way above the Arctic Circle to Inuvik in Canada on the west side of Canada. Yeah, and then you have the Dumpster Highway, which is 1,000 kilometers, 1,000, let's say about 600 miles of gravel road. It's a very remote road. And at the end is a little town of Inuvik. 3,000 people live there. And in the winter, you take the ice road, which is the, on the frozen river, and then on the frozen ocean Arctic, and you arrive to Tuktoyaktuk, which is the last town in this part of the world. And it's a 1,000 people living there. And you drive all that on the ice, on the frozen ocean. And then you come back in summer, all the ice melt, and you have communication by boat. There is no road in summer to go there. So I read an article about that, and I said, wow, I was fascinated, and I wanted to do that. Now, the temperature there is minus 40. It's minus 40 during the day, minus 40 at night. So minus 40 Fahrenheit, you know, it's harsh.
That's cold.
And yeah, it's cold, but, you know, I'm from that school. I mean, when I was a young man in France, I had to drive in winter without gloves, you know, just to challenge it. And not that I had good gloves. We did not have good equipment. I did not have too much money. But it was always the challenge. You know, it is a typical French mentality of the bikers on that time. And I've been trying that all my life. So I was living in New York. In New York, you have New York City, when you have a few days of very, very cold, you know, it goes to minus 10, minus 20, minus 30, and I was fascinated. When I saw the temperature going down like that, I was jumping on my sidecar, trying to drive it to do something. And when it snowed, I was always out on the road, and I learned. I learned through the years how to equip myself, how to manage it, how to deal with it. At one point, I was feeling so good about it. Every time I heard there is a snowstorm on the north going to Canada, I was jumping on my sidecar, but I would do that after work, you know. So I come back home and I prepare myself at 10 o'clock at night. I go on the sidecar, I go to Montreal. And I will arrive in the middle of the night, in the early morning, 350 miles. I will sleep or not sleep, and then I will come back to New York. So little by little, I become prepared to the cold. But the difference is you are in civilized country. So there is always, you're on the road, but you know, you have a cell phone in your hand. And as an expression, if you have a problem, there's a helicopter coming to pick you up. You know, you call a number and you have a AAA something, and you have a gas station, a restaurant, a car will stop. So people will rescue you. Now, I knew going to the dumpster highway, 1,000 kilometers, there is nothing like that. You are in the wild. There is no traffic. And nobody will come to rescue you. So it's a whole different, you know, I'm a city guy. I know nothing about all that. So, yeah, I mean, it was very, it is scary. It is scary. So when I prepare myself to go to the Dancer Highway for the last 3 years before I left on February 16, 2005, I did everything I could to try to learn, you know, to get information, but it was very difficult to get. I was calling the people that were living in Inuvik. And I remember the time I called a garage, and I asked a guy about the tire, what do they do, how it works, you know. And the guy asked me, he said, so what kind of car you have? And without thinking, I didn't pay attention. I said, no, I'm not driving a car, I'm on a motorcycle. The guy hung up on me.
I didn't want to deal with it.
And he hung up. Yeah, I met the guy when I went there, and I told him he was the stupid one. But, I, you know, that's okay. So going there, I had few, I did not know if I could do it. I did not know if it was possible. But I was going on a day-to-day, and I pushed it one day after the other, and look, I went through, you know. So the funny story is when I arrived in Tuktoyaktuk, there is, you know, Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk, they are, it's a petrol country. So a third of the population is the petrol industry. A third of the population is the government. and a third of the population, the last third of the population, are the retired Eskimo who live there. And we are not anymore Eskimo. I mean, there is no more hunting, things like that. Alcohol is a huge drama in this part of the world.
Right.
I saw family devastated. I mean, human drama, you have no idea how hard it is to watch and to listen to these families. These people tell you what happens with member of their own family due to alcohol. So I knew in Tuktoyaktuk, there is one hotel restaurant. I know it has, it's nothing charming because it's a petrol business, petrol industry. So I arrived there, you know, with all this dream I had in my head, and I take my little bag from the sidecar, and I walk the stairs, you know, still dressed like, it's minus 40, right? So I get in the restaurant, in the hotel restaurant, I open the door, and I saw the guy, and, you know, I felt so good. I say, hey, you know, I'm from New York, and I come on my motorcycle to spend the night here. And, you know, that was my... I made it, you know, in my head. So I said that to the guy, and the guy said, well, I'm sorry, but we're full tonight.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's a long way to come to find out they're full.
Yeah. I said, all right. So do you think I can have a soup, eat something? Yeah, of course. Sit down, yeah. And the guy was, you know, obviously very nice. He was worried about me. So I told him, I said, look, don't worry. I have my tent. I sleep outside. If you don't mind to show me where I can pick up my tent, I sleep outside, and it's no problem, you know. So during the dinner, he called me and he said, come have a look. And he took me to an office. It was very small, very messy. And he said, look, if you, would it be okay if you sleep here on the floor? I said, sure, it's okay. So, you know, it all turned out well. So,
Well, that's probably a welcome sight at 40 degrees below zero. That's some chilly camping if you had to stay out there.
Yeah, so, you know, to come back to your question, so then when I left New York, I had in mind Arctic Circle, you know, Tuktoyaktuk. So I made it. So now I'm coming back, and I have one thing in mind, is to go to Ushuaia, because it's logical. It's on the same continent, and it's I'm here. So I'm going to go through Central America and South America down to Ushuaia in Argentina. So that's my goal. Now, which country I'm going to go through, which order, will I go by the East Coast, the West Coast, the Sun? I had no idea. I didn't know. And for all that, I go really on the day-to-day. It depends who I meet, what I heard, what intrigued me. And sometimes I'm just not sure where I go, but I know I'm going south, so it still is good. And that's how I do. So, you know, the beauty for me of my travel is I have no schedule, I have no itinerary, and I have no sponsor. I owe nothing to nobody. I'm totally free. I can do exactly what I want on the day-to-day, and that's what I do, you know. That's what I've been doing.
Wow, that is admirable, and it makes me long for that lifestyle. It's such a simple way to go about each and every day. Just go which way you determine is the best way to go on that given day, and it may change tomorrow, but oh well.
Yeah, exactly, you know. When I was in France, I bought the Ural sidecar, and I had one thing in mind. I wanted to go to Mongolia. I read a book about Mongolia my wife gave me for Christmas. I watched a couple of movies, The Weeping Camel. That was, you know, making me drool to want to go to Mongolia. So I'm preparing the Ural sidecar, and I know I want to go to Mongolia. So will I go through Turkey and the Baltic Sea? Will I go through Belarus? Will I go through the north? And I had no idea, you know. And until 1 week before I left, I heard, I didn't pay attention before, but I heard there is a motorcycle rally at the Arctic Circle in Norway. And I say, wow, that's great. You know, let me go meet all these guys. It's called the Crystal Rally. So I left faster Switzerland than I wanted because I heard about this rally. So I went by there. Then I went by the north. 2 weeks before, I had a TV interview and they asked me, I said, well, man, I don't know. I'm not sure. What do you think I should do? You know, I'm always ready to listen to people, what they have to say, but I will make my decision when it's needed, not because I have to decide in advance. You know, that's a great quality of life it gives me, you know, no stress.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you left the working world to do this, so it's got to be such a night and day difference to walk into a life where you just don't have to worry about what it is you're doing the next day. You know you're going to be getting on your motorcycle, and you know you're going to be turning left or right, and that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I love people stories. Now, 11 years on the road, there must be a good story about a person that you came across that really left an impression on you. Do you have one of those?
Oh, many, many, many.
I'm sure.
No, yeah, of course. Because, you know, what's amazing is you meet people and... Well, number one, I have a billboard above my head, you know, with my traveling with a sidecar. So you stop there, people grab you, you know, in a village, in a remote area, no matter where you are. So people come and they grab you, and they all want to hear your story. They want to ask. They have questions, and it's a pleasure for me to share with people you meet like that. So. Very quickly, they invite you, you know, that they want you to stay, they don't want you to leave, they want you to eat with them, and they want you to sleep in their house. And I do sleep in people's house as much as possible. I do it a lot. You spend one evening, you know, one afternoon, let's say, one evening with a family, with somebody, somewhere. You know, I'm talking villages, I'm talking remote area, I'm not talking about, you know, somebody you meet in a fancy cafe in the capital of the world. No, I'm talking about simple people.
Right.
It's amazing how much people will open to you. All you have to do is to ask them questions, and they will talk to you. And I do the same. I always answer with as much sincerity as I can to any question they ask me. Of course, people ask you mostly. Always the same question. It doesn't matter. You know, people say, are you tired? You always say the same story. I say, look, that's not his problem, you know. I am in his life, in his village. He invites me in his house. He asks me questions, I answer with as much sincerity and simplicity as I can. But that allows me to ask him questions. And you have no idea how much people would open to you. Because being a traveler, you are not a threat. You are just, you know, if I move in a village and I say, okay, I'm going to live here for the next 10 years, he will not open the same way. But I'm just going through, you know, he knows I will leave. So you ask question about what's good in their life, what's a problem they have, what is wrong, what they would like to change, what they would like to achieve. You know, what difficulties they have, and what do they think of such other country next to them that might be in war or might be, you know, in political difficulties together. And people will talk to you, you know, all night long. So that's for me the richest, the richness of my travel is to meet simple people and you have a print of their life in your mind when you leave, you never forget. Now, besides that, you can meet some people, some of them for half an hour, couple of hours, or you meet some people for half a day, and they are, you connect, when you connect with somebody, they are with you, and they are with you for the rest of your life. I can give you some example. I had this one, I'm always thinking, it's Harvey. I was at the Arctic Circle, just coming back, you know, from the from Tuktoyaktuk, and I stopped at the last gas station. I'm still in the north. I have to do the 1,000 kilometer, and I stop at the gas station. I have to fill up gas, and there is no petrol, so we have to wait. They are waiting for the truck. So I've been there for 5 minutes, and comes this guy Harvey. He's on the old pickup truck. He had the sled dog, you know, the
Huskies.
You understand?
Yep.
Yeah. And the guy, I mean, you can see his face, you know, his big beard and all that. He's a character. His pickup truck is like old, very old. And we start talking to it together. And he's sleeping in his truck with his dogs. The night before he went to the dumpster, he was very happy because he find two tires that fit the wheel he had. He said, when I finish dog sled with my dogs, I'm to come back home, which is over 1,000 miles about. He say, you know, the tire I have are not good enough. So now I'm happy. I have a couple of spare tires, you know, with me. So that not much money, you know, but the guy was going with his sled dog solo, and he was living for 2 weeks at a time, you know, so he would park his pickup truck, go with his dog for 2 weeks in the wild, and come back, you know. That was what he was doing. So we talked for 2 hours together, and he's still with me, you know. I had an email from him not even a week ago. And one thing he say, I love that. I put all that on my website. At one point he said, you know, because we don't have a job, people think that we don't work. He said, well, to succeed at what we do, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, no doubt.
I love that. It's true. You know, he was kind of like me, not working anymore, not much money. But, it's true. People think we don't work, but that's a lot of work.
He's working harder than most.
Well, I mean, you know, everything works, but yeah, it takes work. So, yeah, you connect with people. To me, that's what travel is about, is to connect with people. Last night, I had an email from a girl, a young girl I met in St. Petersburg. So St. Petersburg must have been in 2009, when I was on my way to Mongolia. I spent a couple of days with her. I met her in St. Petersburg. We went to the opera together, and then we had dinner with her in her house with her mom. And, you know, again, she told me a lot of things I know about her life. So on that time, she had difficulties. She met an Italian guy that she was in love. She wanted to go join him, but she could not get the visa. It was very difficult financially. You know, there were not rich people at all, this girl and her mom. And it's very difficult for Russian to have visa to go to Europe. You know, you have to show a lot of, it's mostly a financial problem. You have to show bank statement for 2 years past and so on. So I saw this girl two times in 2 days, and then I went on with my travel. So I got an email from her once a year. You know, I'm sending a mass email to everybody I know, everybody I met, everybody. And she answered me to say, well, I'm glad to see you are still on the road and so on. So I wrote her back and I say, hey, well, what about you? You know, what's happening in your life now? Where are you at? Tell me since we met together. And she wrote me a long letter I got last night about she succeeded to go meet this guy in Italy. She married him. She lived in Tuscany. She got a job traveling around the world for 3 years. Then she got tired of traveling, and now she's looking for another job. You know, we met 2 days, but we are connected for life. You know, I will follow this girl. She will follow me until ever, you know. So yeah. That, to me, this is the true richness of the travel.
Yeah, that's very special. Absolutely. Money couldn't buy that.
Yeah. So I'm used to say, you know, I don't do, when I travel, I don't do fort, I don't do church, I don't do mosque, I don't do synagogue, I don't do landmark. I can do, but I don't care. You know, I'm not looking for. But I do villages, I do remote road, I do mountain, I do people. Not the kind of travel I do.
Well, that sounds good to me. I like the way that that you do it, and the mentality that you hold while you're doing it. So
sometimes I will go see a landmark place, but like I'm living in India, I have been here for a year and a half. I did not go to see the Taj Mahal.
Right.
Yeah. People don't understand that, but that's, to me, that's not very important. You know, that's it.
I think you would describe yourself as a world traveler instead of a tourist. You don't hit all the tourist spots. You want to see the world.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's different.
You've been all over the place. Could you pick a place that you would say is your absolute favorite, that really is a place that you could go back to time and time again and never get old?
Oh, very simple. Very simple and no hesitation. It's Mongolia.
Is it? I spent
9 months in Mongolia. So I arrived in November, beginning of the winter. And like I always do when I go in a country, when I know I want to spend some time, I took a teacher one-on-one, 4 hours a day, to learn to speak Mongol. So I have my own booklet with my own vocabulary, my own sentences. All I want this teacher is to teach me the phonetic, how to say such a sentence, such a verb, such a name. So after 2 weeks of that, I have enough ammunition to speak the local language, to present myself, to explain my story, and to ask questions, and it works very, very well. So, of course, when people answer you something, I understand nothing. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not when you arrive somewhere, you speak their language, you break the barrier, you open the door. So I did that when I arrived in Mongolia. And then I went right away in my same thing. Mongolia, the steppe of Mongolia, the Gobi Desert is minus 40 Fahrenheit in winter. And I went south right away and not knowing anybody, nobody was waiting for me, and it's very, very remote in the winter, this part of the world. But I stopped in New York, and I start spending time with these people, the hospitality the Mongol people have, the lifestyle they have. So, and I spent 9 months like that. So I spent the whole winter and the spring and the summer. Now, why do I love so much Mongolia? Is because in the 21st century today, the Mongol nomads, they are true nomads. They still move their pasture for 5, 6, 7 times a year. But they live today with the same harshness it was, the same difficulties and the same hierarchy and the same family value and the same simplicity than they were living 1,000 years ago under Genghis Khan. Nothing changed. It's totally amazing. That's what I read in my book, that's what I saw in the movie The Weeping Camel, and that's what I wanted to live with these people, to be there with them. And I spent as much as a couple of nights with them in their yurt and as long as a month and a half in the same yurt with the same family. So it gives you a lot of time to understand and to witness, you know, to see what, to really live with them, you know, the same rhythm they live. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's magnificent to see that there is such an authenticity of life, of lifestyle preserved today.
Yeah, it's like history stood still, and the landscape is just absolutely beautiful, you know, from what I've seen.
Well, the landscape is pretty flat, huh? It's not, you know, but But it's weird because you can go through the steppe. There is no one road to go south. You have, you know, you drive on your own. You make your own path, you know.
Right.
So it's very, very open territory. And then you see a yurt, you know, like far away. It might be like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kilometers. And you start to go this way. And they have a hospitality, unbelievable hospitality. You know, there is a, when you approach a yurt, every yurt has a dog. And the purpose of the dog is, it's a warning system for the nomad. So the dog sleep outside, summer or winter, and if there is something strange happening or a bad animal or something, he will bark. That's his job. And then the nomad will come out of the yurt and look what it is and deal with it. So when I approach a yurt, they are barking at me. And there is a tradition. When the nomad come out of the yurt and you are facing each other, you tell him, it's a specific sentence, you know, I forget it now, but it's a specific sentence. You say, can you please watch out your dog? And he's invariably, he will tell you, yes, I pay attention to my dog. And that means you are welcome. From that time, he takes you inside the yurt. As soon as you are inside the yurt, he gives you something to drink, a tea, most likely. And then he starts to prepare you something to eat, a snack, a cookies, or he starts heating some water. I mean, in winter, he would start a fire to cook you some food. And you are there. So we talk, we communicate. It takes time. It's a slow process, but it works. And then at the end of the day, you know, nobody has question. He's not going to ask you which hotel you go sleep tonight. Of course not. And he said, you know, we push a yurt is properly like 20-25 feet diameter. It's one volume. There is no partition, so there is no place to hide. 3, 4, 5, 6 people can live in a yurt typically. So there is no furniture. You have little teeny stool that you can, you know, like not even 1 foot high, and that you sit on. And at night, you pull things on the side, you put the cover, and you sleep on the floor. So when it's night, you say, okay, you lie down here, you know, boom, and you lie down. And never, not once in 9 months, any nomad asked me, so what's your plan? What do you do next? How long do you stay? When are you leaving? Never. And I stay a week. I stay up to a month and a half in the same family. Never, nobody asked me when I was going and what was my plan.
Wow, that's hospitality.
It's a natural hospitality, you know, that is absolutely amazing. You know?
Right.
Mongols are very content of their life. Because there is zero agriculture. It's only, they only have, you know, their sheep, goats, cow, horses, camel, yak. Basically, that's all they have. And these animals, you know, they go out to eat, you know, they walk on the steppes all day long. They come back at night at the yurt. But the Mongol, has a lot of time for himself. So between them, in the family, they socialize a lot. They spend a lot of time talking together, having fun. They laugh a lot. They have social games. They would play. They eat all day long. You know, they eat a little snack here, a little snack there. They sip some tea, and they have a good time, you know, life is good. It is very harsh in winter. But beside that, they are very content on their life.
Well, it sounds like a lifestyle that many of us could probably benefit from living, at least to get a taste of, just for a little while.
Yeah, so look, you know, it is true also that today, when I was there in 2009, some of the Mongol nomads already have a Chinese motorcycle. Some have a solar panel with a dish and a TV. It's only one channel coming from Ulaanbaatar. Some have a cell phone. So sometimes, you know, you can pick up a signal somewhere and they were able to call on the phone. All that exists already. It's not like they don't know. It does exist. Not everybody has it, but some of them have it. But it did not change anything on their own lifestyle. You know, the rhythm is the same. The lifestyle is still the same. The same simplicity and the same hierarchy and value of life, you know.
Right. What words...
So Mongolia is my number one by far.
Yeah, I can imagine. What words of inspiration or advice would you have for somebody who really has a dream to do what you've done now that you've done it for 11 years and have all this experience under your belt? What would you tell them?
Do it. That's it. If you have the dream to do it, then do it, you know?
As simple
as that. I would never encourage anybody to do it. I don't care to tell people you should travel. If you want to travel, you travel. You know, it's a free world, to a degree. But at the opposite of that, I would tell everybody I meet, every family, I say, if you want to do one thing good for your kids, make them travel. Take them outside the no matter where you live, which country you live, which part of the world you live in. Take your kids to travel. It's so important because when you come back home, you can appreciate in a totally different way whatever is home. Would it be for an American kid? Well, you know what? A lot. It's very important for American kid because so many Americans have no idea of the rest of the world, you know. So if you take your kids to travel, they come back home, they have a maturity in them that is the most valuable. So, yeah, I say that to everybody. Take your kids to travel. Go where you want, the way you want, doesn't matter. They will see other parts of the world. They will come back. They will enrich their soul, you know.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We've had people on who have raised their kids on a sailboat circumnavigating the globe, you know, for 6 years, and you know, I always marvel at what those kids must have seen and learned and experienced out there, and what that has done, and how that has set them up for adulthood. You know, moving forward, it's just a truly amazing opportunity. So you're absolutely spot on with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have a friend I was living a couple of months ago. He took his son. He has four kids. The youngest is a boy. He's 10 years old. So he prepared, he's a pilot, airplane pilot, commercial pilot. So he took a sabbatical year, he bought a Ural sidecar. I mean, it just happens he did it on a Ural, you know, that's how I met him, because he has a Ural, but it doesn't matter. And he took his son out of the school, and he traveled all the country of Europe for 1 year. I mean, the maturity this kid built to himself during that year, it's amazing, you know. It's fantastic. He's not the same kid anymore, you know. What he learned there is invaluable by compared to all the other kids who stay home and playing their electronic stupid game, you know. You cannot replace that yet, to me.
Yeah, it's life transforming for sure.
It's life transforming, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have a website, and your website is really, it truly a treasure trove of world travel adventure. You must spend quite a bit of time updating it, or is it just a matter of this is 11 years worth of updates? And
No, look, you know, I started the website for my daughters. I have three daughters. So I started first I was sending email when I left in 2005. So I was sending email to my friends, of course, my daughter, my family, my friends. And then about 6 months after I was on the road, you know, I was, I mean, the idea was there. Yeah, I should do a website. People were telling me that. So I started the website. And I knew I wanted big photograph, fast loading, little caption. You know, I don't know how to write, but I know I could tell a little story. And so that's what I've been doing. So when you travel alone, you know, people say always say, well, isn't it difficult to be always alone? You know, well, you are alone if you want to be alone. Because when I stop somewhere, people grab me if I want to open myself to them. And so, in fact, I'm never alone.
Yeah, never a problem.
Yeah, but you have also one thing. It's your camera. Your camera is your friend. That's with your camera you share what you are living at every moment. You know, you take a photograph, this photograph will be shared with your family and friend. So with this camera, the camera you have in your hand is your friend. It's your kids, it's your wife, it's your people you love that are there with you, you know. So doing the website takes time. It takes a lot of time. But I do it on a day-to-day. And again, because I'm totally free, I don't owe anything to anybody, I say that from the beginning. I will only put stories and photographs and stories if I have a story to tell. If I don't have a story to tell, I will put nothing. So sometimes I had a period where I was not putting anything. Then I get email. What's wrong with you there?
Yeah, right.
There's nothing is wrong with me. You know, I'm just resting. Give me a break. You know? So, yeah. But, yes, it takes time. But I love the concept of this website with large photograph and caption and telling story, not taking myself seriously, making fun. A little sarcasm is always good. And that's, you know, that's my partner, you know, that's how I communicate with people. So, yeah, I do that with them. You know, you asked me before we started if I had a book or something I wanted to promote. Let me tell you something. I had a small business all my life, one way or the other. I was always in the red. I was never good for one simple reason. When you have a small business, your job number one is to sell. And I'm a bad salesman. That's why it's just how it is. So being a bad salesman, and I suffered from that. I knew I was a bad salesman. You know, but I didn't know how to be a good one. You know, if not, I tried. Believe me, I tried very hard. I could never succeed to become a good salesman. So all my business were always not okay, and I was always struggling. I never made it financially, you know, in my businesses. So when I sold everything, I go on the road, I promised myself, I say, I have enough money for 10 years. After 10 years, I have nothing left. So I sell everything, that the cash, I put it at the bank. Number one, I put this money on the saving account. So everybody jump on me. No, you have to invest. I say, fuck you. I'm not going to invest nothing. I keep this money saving, but you have to lose with the, I say, I don't care. If I lose 5%, it doesn't bother me. But if I lose 30% because I made a stupid investment, it would kill me, you know? So I put this money inside. And why am I telling that? I forget. I lost my throat.
you didn't want something to promote. You didn't want to have to sell.
Oh,
stuff.
Yeah. So I have the money to travel for 10 years, very secure, because there is no risk on this little capital of money I have. And one thing I promised myself, I will never sell anything again in my life. Because I've been suffering selling, I don't want to sell, I was bad at selling, so I would never sell again anything. So people tell me, well, you write a book. I said, no, I'm not writing a book. But you should write a book. You could. I said, no. I said, look, I do the writing, you do the writing. You write the book, you have everything on my website, start writing, ask me questions, I tell you anecdotes, I have plenty of anecdotes in my head, and that's it. So I'm not selling anything, not one T-shirt, not one book, not anything. I made quite a few conferences, you know, presentations in the motorcycle circle, you know, Uran or else, you know, and never ask for $1 when I do that, never. You know, I just do it for the pleasure to meet people, to share with people, and, you know, they ask me questions, I answer. And for me, when I do that, I always meet a few great people also, you know, so it's a two-way street.
Yeah, yeah, so, I completely understand that.
Nothing to sell.
Okay.
Now, some people say, but I saw you have a link. I have a link on my website for donation. I say, yeah. You want to give me, I take it. You know, I say, thank you. But you have nothing in exchange, you know, so don't drop anything.
That's great. Well, I do want to point listeners to your website, because like I said, it truly is a treasure trove of adventure. And I really, once I stumbled upon it, I just really kind of got lost in your travels, you know, because you depicted on your site, you know, with your comments and the photos of it. And you can get lost and be there vicariously, you know, if you can't be there physically. And it's such a neat site to visit. So I want to read it out myself. It's thetimelessride.com. That's where you can go and read all about Hubert Kriegel's adventures around the world on the Ural for 11 years. And it sounds like you're not planning on stopping anytime soon. Am I right?
Well, no, that has changed. You know, number one, the name, The Timeless Ride, is I was on the phone with my wife and my daughter Jessica before I left, and so how are we going to call that? And they come with the name The Timeless Ride. So it's a ride that has no beginning and no end. And as you know, life is made of confusion. If you look on the first page of my website, The Timeless Ride, no beginning, no end, but it's 10 years on the road. So, and then it says B, started from New York February 16 at 6:04 a.m. So not only it has a beginning time, it has an end time, and it's a timeless ride. But, what did I say that? I don't remember. Okay.
January
11th.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I'm in my 11th year now. So what happens is, you know, that night when we scooped the number with my friend Jean-Louis in New York, and it was just common sense. It happens our common sense was right on target. When I started travel, I have been spending exactly what we imagined that day. I'm not spending more, I'm not spending less. And I do it by instinct, you know, I don't keep track, I don't write anything. I don't write how many kilometers I rode, how much I spent, anything. Every 2-3 months, I would open the website, my bank account in New York, my bank account in France. I look the balance, and I look, and I, boom, I'm right on my feet. And when I reached 62 years old, it was the age of retirement in America. Security called me. I stopped by them. And to make it short to you, you know, because I was always in the red, I never had 401k or retirement plan, nothing. But I had paycheck all my life. I work hard like anybody else. So on every paycheck, there is something going on the side for Social Security. When I was working in France, as well as when I was working in America. To make it short, it happens that my budget of traveling is exactly the amount I have in retirement, which is much, much, much better than I never imagined anything. You know, the day we did this number with Jean-Louis about how much I have, we talk about retirement. But I was born in 1946 in Paris. So 1946, right after the war, my parents were very poor. They did not have any money until I was 10 years old. So all my young boy, you know, in education, what I was hearing about retirement, say, well, people who go to retire, they are, when they get old, they are sick, they suffer, they have no money, and they die. It did not look too good, you know, the retirement. It changed, you know, So when we scooped the number with Jean, we put zero for retirement. I knew I would have like a few hundred dollars or something, but nothing substantial to that we put on.
Right.
Totally wrong. With the French and the American retirement, I had enough to travel on the lifestyle I had already. So all of a sudden, all the pressure went down. And now I'm traveling with my retirement money. So when I reach the 10 years, it's official. Now I'm on the road. I'm on the road for good. You know, as long as I can put one foot in from the other one, I'm still traveling.
That's great. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Life is pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, before we go, I have to ask, you have these iconic red glasses that you seem to be recognized for at this point. Is there a story behind these glasses, or you just like the color red?
Yeah. I got this red glasses in 1995, so 21 years I've been wearing these glasses. They are big, red, flashy, huge frame red. So, you know, if you look at the website, you will understand once you see a photograph of me with my red glasses, which I wear 24, every day. it's a girl I met. She was a friend. I recently met. She was an eyeglass maker, you know, designer. And she called me and she said, look, I have some glasses I'm designing. I want to show you. So stop by my shop one day. So I stopped by her shop. It was this red glasses, and I loved it right away. Because, let me explain you. It's hard to understand, but most likely you will not understand. But that's okay. I'm a shy person. I've been shy all my life. You know, that's who I am. So to wear such a flashy red glasses. Now, people don't look at me. They look at the glasses. So it allowed me to be there without having people looking at me. It's confusing. I know, but,
no, you know, I completely right. get it. I understand what you're saying. That makes a lot of sense. That's great.
Yeah.
So there is a story behind the red glasses.
Yeah. So I was living in New York. I had a small business of graphic arts. And, you know, it was fitting very well the environment, you know. I was, everybody thought I was this huge advertising agency. I was not, you know.
All it takes is red glasses, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get a pair. Well, Hubert, your travels sound truly amazing, and I was very anxious to get you on because your stories are exactly what we're looking for on this show. I think they're absolutely inspiring, and I look forward to seeing what comes down the road next for you. And I'll follow your site and see that happen. And I can only hope that we cross paths at some point so I can shake your hand and hear a few more stories.
Yeah, that would be great. But look, I want to say something. You know, people always ask, you know, why the sidecar, why the motorcycle? I say, look, when you travel, it's not important what motorcycle you have. And I'm going to tell you, if there was one motorcycle made for traveler who never break, we would all knew it and we would all have it. It does not exist. So there is nothing wrong or right on the choice of motorcycle. As long as you are happy on your own motorcycle, your own choice, then you are the winner. I will say more. It doesn't matter if you travel on a motorcycle, if you travel on a bicycle, on a car, on a backpack, in a bus, as long as you go on the road. You know, so the purpose is travel, is to meet with people, is to connect with people. And for people who say, you know, should I go? Oh, I'm dreaming to go on the road. Say, look, if you feel about it, do it. You know, you ask me the question. I would never push anybody to do it, but just do it. So some people over-prepare themselves because we live Colorado, you know, Europe, France, America. We live in such sophisticated country. We could prepare. I know some people that are preparing for years.
Right.
Before they go on the road. They will never go on the road. That's fine, you know. I mean, maybe their pleasure is to prepare. It doesn't matter. If they want to go on the road, they will. Don't over-prepare. You know, many times people say, well, I would go, but I need this, I need that. I say, no, you don't, you know. You start to go on the road, and you will finish to prepare as you are on the road. You know, you will know what works, what does not work for you. And maybe traveling like that is not for you. Then if it is not for you, you come back home. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. It's only if you're happy you do it. Because traveling on motorcycle or car, I mean, traveling around the world is not, it requires a special state of mind. You forget about the comfort zone. Every day you approach a new situation. You approach new people. You approach new country. And you have new difficulties or unknown in front of you. So you have to be able to eat whatever people give you to eat. You have to learn to speak their language. You really have to go out of your comfort zone, circle of comfort zone. And it's not for everybody, but if it is for you, you will love it. It's, traveling is amazing. You know? Even if it is harder and harder these days, the way the world is going now, but, still, it's fantastic.
Yeah, well said. Just get out there and do it and don't have any inhibitions. And don't plan too much. You'll never get going if you do.
Yeah, don't overcomplicate it, you know. Things will happen. And also, one other thing I want to tell you, because your audience is maybe mostly American. There is no way, I've been traveling 80 countries in the world on motorcycle, one way or the other. And there is no one country in the world where people are mean. It just does not exist. No matter where you are, you have a problem, you will find people who will help you. Now, you might have country with a political situation with your own country. You might have difficulty with a custom agent. You might have problem with a corrupted policeman. You might have problem with military or government or the administration. But that's not the people. Not the system. So there is no such a thing as a country where people are mean. I was welcome in every country I went in. You know, I remember when I arrived in Venezuela with my BMW Saka with a New York City license plate. I replaced the license plate and I thought, people see I'm from New York, American, I'm going to be in trouble. People don't give a damn, they're lovely. They say, you're from the, little by little, I was opening myself, and they're absolutely lovely. So everywhere you go, you will find very, very nice people. And then whenever you have a problem, you will find people to help you.
Right. Yep, absolutely true. That message comes across quite often with the people we interview, and we hear the same message time and time again, is that everywhere they go, the people that they meet are just absolutely genuine, helping, caring, and they'll give you the shirt off their back.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. All right, Hubert. Well, safe travels. Enjoy India, and I will be looking forward to seeing where you go next. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and inspire our listeners to get out there and do something for themselves.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I see you on the road one of these days.
Sounds good. Thanks. Take care.
Thank you, Travis. Bye-bye.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.